1290 AM Denmark, W250 CV Green Bay,
and always streaming on the Civic Media app.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Communication breakdown. Local SWAT team members on duty during the assassination attempt on former President Trump 2 weeks ago, speaking out exclusively to ABC News. Patrick Young, Chief Detective of Emergency Services in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, says a lot of respects. There was a communications failure before the gunman opened fire that way.
Multiple agencies working together is always taxing, no matter what the problem. I know that we could not communicate with Secret Service or Pennsylvania State Police, or really in effort, the patrol directly.
The world is watching the Middle East amid new fears of a larger war. A Hezbollah rocket killing 12 children and teenagers in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. Israel has blamed Hezbollah. U.S. diplomats working today to contain hostilities. Crews in California making progress on the Park Fire. It's larger than the city of Los Angeles, but now about 10% contained. This is ABC News. Venezuelans headed to the polls today for a high-stakes presidential election. The authoritarian regime of Nicolas Maduro facing one of its toughest challenges in years. U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken.
The entire international community is going to be watching this very closely. We urge all parties to honor their commitments and to respect the democratic process.
Blinken making the comment in Tokyo, where he's joining Defense Secretary Lloyd Austin for security talks on China and North Korea. As for Maduro, he's warned of a bloodbath if he doesn't win there, and there are fears his re-election could set off another wave of immigration from a country where millions have already left amid a years-long economic collapse. Rallies, marches, and vigils are being held across the country today in the U.S. for the memory of Sonia Massey. The National Day of Mourning pays tribute to the mother of two who was shot to death by an Illinois police deputy in her home. That deputy, Sean Grayson, has been fired from the force and charged with murder. Dave Packer, ABC News.
Protect your engine with Quaker State and save big money at Menards. Quaker State Full Synthetic Motor Oil is engineered to give your engine more power, more wear protection, longer engine life, and more performance. Save big money on all Quaker State products at Menards. America's number one home improvement retailer for customer satisfaction, according to J.D. Power. For J.D. Power 2024 award information, visit jdpower.com/awards.
Save big money at Menards.
The president ends his re-election campaign.
And the Civic Media team, led by Todd Albaugh and Terry Bell, brings you the breaking news.
After days, if not weeks, of advice to pull out of his re-election campaign.
President Biden releasing this letter, quote, I believe it is in the best interest for me to stand down.
Real news and great conversation.
You can count on it on your local Civic Media radio station and on the Civic Media app.
I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News. Your news in depth. Find it in the news section at WGBW.fm.
For Civic Media News, I'm Terry Bell. One in eight people in Wisconsin could find it harder to afford food under the U.S. House version of the Farm Bill. Mike Moan reports.
The Supplemental Nutrition Assistance Program, or SNAP, falls under the Farm Bill, which needs to be reauthorized by the end of September. House Republicans have blocked efforts to maintain White House authority to make non-inflationary adjustments to SNAP benefits. Megan Rowe with the group Opportunity Wisconsin says not having that option would put recipients at a disadvantage.
SNAP benefits help over 700,000 Wisconsinites afford food, which is one in eight people in our state. And so gutting this assistance would mean that these families have to make difficult choices.
The Congressional Budget Office says removing the provision would limit the scope of future SNAP increases by $30 billion. Advocates say that amounts to a large cut. Wisconsin Republican Congressman Derek Van Orden was called out for a recent committee vote to keep the option shelved. In a social media post, he accused Democrats of lying when saying the panel was cutting benefits. Suzanne Becker of the Feed My People Food Bank in Eau Claire says politics shouldn't come into play. She argues elevating SNAP levels as much as possible is a wise move.
We can never replace the impact that SNAP has on our neighbors. Nonprofits can't do that. We make a difference every day. We strive to. But this is a critical piece in making sure that all Americans have what they need.
Becker says her location sees a lot of demand among working families. Her team works with income-eligible clients to sign up for SNAP benefits, noting it's a lifeline for older populations. This is Mike Moen for Wisconsin News Connection. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
You're listening to Civic Media News. I'm Terry Bell.
More news, conversations, and a whole lot of fun. It's all on your local Civic Media radio station or the Civic Media app.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine for your Sunday, but there will be a chance of some showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs warming to the middle 80s, south winds of 5 to 10. One or two showers or storms this evening, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 60s. Right now it's 82.
Jane Matinair and Greg Bach.
Coming up on the show, we talk to the organization Parents as Teachers, what that would mean for you, mom and dad, and your kids. Plus, all the news from the weekend, we'll recap it. Join us.
Matinair on air, weekday mornings at 10. The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
Welcome to Amicus, a law review with Jim Santel, Civic Media's weekly review and discussion of some of the most significant news stories in the areas of law, government, courts, and the aspiration for justice. And now, here's your host, Jim Santel.
This is Amicus, a law review. My name is Jim Santel, your host for this, our second hour on our weekend weekly roundup, a review of all things related to justice and law and government in America, spending most of our first hour talking about the absence of any basis upon which these forthcoming and present lawsuits challenging the Democratic nominee for the presidency, the insufficiency, the inadequacy, the lack of any substance to these various lawsuits being brought to challenge what's going on inside the Democratic Party, and also then talking now about the United States Supreme Court and some very interesting comments made by one of the justices, Elena Kagan, when she is at the Ninth Circuit Conference just this past week, talking about the need for an enforcement mechanism for a true and credible ethics code, commenting that while she regards the Chief Justice with great regard and regards him as someone she respects and admires, that he should put together some sort of a panel, some sort of a committee, presumably of lower court judges, to make these determinations about an enforceable code of ethics. And significant not only because of the identification for the first time by her or other justices about this enforcement issue, which is significant, the mechanism for actually imposing upon the justices, they follow some rules and regulations when it comes to their conduct, their recusals, their behavior, but also a way of ensuring that they themselves are not policing themselves, as she said, and looking presumably to some other set of judges, some other committee, as she proposed, of federal judges who would impose their perspectives on those of the associate justices and the chief justice. Fascinating to think about that. And again, significant because of the articulation by this associate justice of this view. She'd commented a couple of other things that are also relevant to what we see a lot. We saw a lot of this in this past term. She also criticized the number of concurrences being written by justices in connection with majority and even other opinions that are attached, even dissent. She said that the code of conduct, as important as it is also accompanied by some frustration that she has with a large number of these concurrences of her colleagues issuing in cases. And she says it's not a good thing for the court. Those are her words. And what are concurrences? Concurrences are these additional writings that the justices will attach to majority opinions, saying, I agree with what the majority is doing. I agree with the overall result of the court, but I'm going to write something specially to explain why it is that I come to that same result, why I think I should be heard on this. And she goes on to say this. She says, I think all these concurrences prevent us from giving the kind of guidance that lower courts have a right to expect, the public has a right to expect. It muddies the waters of our decisions, she says. She specifically pointed the court's decision, which we've talked a lot about here on this broadcast, this case of Rahimi, this major Second Amendment case the court decided not too long ago, majority by an 8-1 ruling upholds this federal ban on a domestic abuser's right to have guns. You cannot possess, cannot use weapons in this country if there is a pending domestic violence restraining order against you. Supreme Court affirmed that federal law, that federal prohibition in this case called Rahimi, 8-1 ruling. And Justice Roberts, Chief Justice Roberts, wrote that case, wrote that decision for the majority. But a flurry of separate writings followed that, and we talked about some of those by many members of the court. And that prompted Elena Kagan just this past week to comment about that. She says, everybody sort of tries to spin it one way or another. Often people use separate opinions to pre-decide issues that aren't properly before the court and that may come before the court in a year or two. And they try then to sort out or give some signals to how lower courts should decide that. She says, which I don't think it's right. There are definitely times, she says, when separate opinions make sense. And she notes that she wrote one of those this session. But she says, I think all the time that we're in a position where we look at the majority opinion and we say, not the way we would have written it, but I think we should have a higher threshold for saying, but it will do. It's okay. It's enough. I agree with it enough. And the world doesn't need to hear my separate thoughts on a better opinion that could have been written. Again, advocating for fewer concurrences so that the waters are not muddied for all of us, including the lower courts. Fascinating to hear her talk about that frustration that she has on the Supreme Court. And then she also joins with all of this a concern about the so-called emergency document. She says she's growing impatient with the increased use of the court's emergency docket, in which the court can issue unsigned and unexplained orders that allow the justices to act on a certain case while also pretty much shielding the legal analysis behind the decision and the exact vote count by the justices themselves. The use of the emergency, sometimes called the shadow docket, increased dramatically during the Trump administration, as we have talked about previously. The Justice Department seeking to use that docket and seeking relief in various cases that affect very significant issues. Under the Biden administration, GOP states and other private litigants have also used the docket in challenging various federal actions, often forcing the court to hear the merits of those disputes in this sort of emergency setting. The Biden administration has also used it from time to time. Everybody, according to Elena Kagan, using it much too much. She says, because we have granted a number of them in the early years of the Trump administration, I think it encouraged people to keep bringing these kinds of petitions for emergency relief from various lower court orders. And significantly, there are several matters that are pending on the Supreme Court's docket right now on this emergency docket. We're going to talk about one of them soon in this hour, having to do with the Department of Education's rules under Title IX, and that also affect transgender issues in America. Those cases immediately coming up to the court, and also a part of the emergency docket, also a part of what Elena Kagan is criticizing, overusing the emergency docket, the so-called shadow docket, a part of her criticism of the court in the Ninth Circuit Conference just this past week. Interesting to hear from her about all of these things, especially this focus that plainly she has still on the need for an enforceable ethics code, proposing that it be administered by a group of non-Supreme Court justices somewhere in the federal judiciary to review what the Supreme Court justices are doing in terms of ethics, in terms of recusal, in terms of their behavior, and making that the enforcement mechanism for whatever the code may be. Fascinating to hear from Elena Kagan just this past week. Also good to hear from callers here on Amicus Law Review. Appreciate always your questions, your inquiries at 844-967-2789, or also drop us a question in the Civic Media feed, the online app. Mark from Prairie du Sac, Mark calling in this weekend. Appreciate, as always, Mark, your question or your inquiry.
Yeah, thanks for taking my call. Yeah, it seems to me that the Constitution itself calls out for a code of ethics or implies a code of ethics based on how Article 2 ends in the Constitution with what civic officers can be removed for. I believe it's treason, bribery, high crimes, and other misdemeanors. And then Article 3, it starts out with it, judges serve during times of good behavior. So if you link those two together, good behavior should include not accepting any kind of bribes or gratuities, which is the ridiculous thing. Well, if you take it after the fact, it's not a bribe anymore, it's just a gratuity the Supreme Court just came up with. It's just ridiculous to me because even in antiquity, it was not accepted that judges should be taking bribes. It was something that was deeply concerning to the rulers at the time. You know, the people actually had to trust the law, even though the law at the time was probably a sorry sop to the common individual out there. They figured the law had to be a sacrosanct and be above taking, you know, the judges actually taking bribes. I mean, that it is disturbing to me also that we have members of the Supreme Court that apparently have voiced opinions that the 13th, 14th, and 15th, and probably the 16th Amendment aren't valid amendments to the Constitution because they're actually forced upon the recalcitrant states being brought back into the Union, the Confederacy, and they're forced to sign off on those amendments because to actually rejoin the Union. So they have made arguments that those amendments are not valid.
Right. And lots of things to unpack there, Mark, including your very good thoughts about this ethics notion that it does, in fact, derive from what is Article 3 of our Constitution, which is the article that establishes our federal judiciary. It's implicit in all of that language there and beyond that. The people of America anticipate that when they get decisions from our Supreme Court and our lower courts as well, that all of those decisions are a product of independent, unbiased, unprejudiced views about what the law and the facts command and require, and are not the product of some internal bias or prejudice that they may have, or some connection to the parties who are appearing right in front of them, things that they've gotten, also just generally to know about the sources of income for our justices, for our judges. That's also good to know, simply to affirm that we know what the representatives, whether it's in Congress, whether President of the United States of America, where they're getting their monies. That is a significant thing for an open and complete democracy to understand about its leadership. And always, always, Mark, appreciate your good insights and questions. We appreciate also, again, the notion that our Congress, which I just mentioned, is also dealing with what the Supreme Court has done just this past term. We have talked a lot about this major decision issued on June 28th in this case called Loper Bright Enterprises, basically changing the way that government works and finding that the deference long established for 40 years under this principle called Chevron is no longer the rule of law in America, giving great power to federal judges. It really is identified in many ways as a significant, dramatic, one of the most significant changes in the way that government works. Well, it turns out that Congress has noted that and has already beginning to introduce legislation that is going to overturn that decision in Loper Bright Enterprises. Among others in the United States Senate is Senator Elizabeth Warren, introducing bills that would restore that previous standard under which federal agencies did, in fact, have discretion to interpret the law when they issued regulations under statutes issued by the Congress, also appropriately giving those agencies the authority to act. Has the backing already inside the Senate of nine other Democrats, others, it's picking up steam there. Beyond that, Elizabeth Warren talking about the reasons for this, including transparency and efficiency to federal rulemaking, making certain corporate interest groups can't substitute their preferences for the judgment of Congress and the expert agencies. As we continue here on Amicus Law Review, we're going to talk more about what's going on in Congress in response to those recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for the Todd Allball Show.
Few Wisconsin events bring 600,000 people together from 80 different countries, but it happens every summer in Oshkosh.
Oshkosh has become synonymous with the world of flight and with EAA.
Dick Napinski's worked with EAA Air Venture for more than 30 years and knows its history. Do you? Where did EAA start? Wausau? La Crosse or Milwaukee? The answer coming up. The fly-in is spread across 1,600 acres with more than 10,000 airplanes. It brings a big boost to the economy, too.
It's $170 million of economic impact and more than $110 million of direct spending.
So where did EAA start? Milwaukee in 1953 called the Wisconsin Air Pageant with 21 planes. All moved to Oshkosh in 1970, a high-flying slice of Wisconsin. It's happening July 22nd to the 28th. I'm Terry Barr.
The Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Jim Santel, and yes, this is Amicus Law Review. We are doing all things law, government, and administration of justice in our nation, including the attention provided by the United States Congress, United States Senate, the House of Representatives in recent days to these recent decisions of the United States Supreme Court. One of them involving Loper Bright Enterprises is the name of the case. That case involving this notion that the agencies of our federal government are no longer given the deference due to them based upon their expertise, the insight that they have in doing their jobs. The Chevron doctrine rescinded, revoked, dismissed, and kicked to the curbside by the United States Supreme Court in this Loper Bright Enterprises case. Legislation introduced in the United States Senate by Elizabeth Warren, joined in by others, restore that standard, that Chevron standard, in the legislative mechanism through that process. The law, the proposed legislation, is called the Stop Corporate Capture Act, interesting name for it, and would write Chevron deference back into the law, restore what the Supreme Court took away, and would basically undercut what the Supreme Court recently did, giving agencies more discretion that was taken away from them by the Supreme Court in that recent decision. Interestingly, while the senators are there, they're also focusing on some other things related to agencies. The legislation advanced by Senator Warren and others would also bolster agency rulemaking in some other significant ways. Provisions aimed at streamlining an often very lengthy process. We know that as a part of the rulemaking mechanism. And also to defend the independent scientific expertise, the people who know what they're talking about inside these agencies by doing a number of things and quite requiring, for example, anyone submitting public comments to disclose their industry-funded research or any other potential conflicts of interest. In other words, when you submit comments to suggest that the agency, the expertise inside the agency should either be supported or not supported, a requirement under the law that you also identify the source of any funding for your research and any potential conflicts of interest in this very issue. Interesting add-ons as the United States Senate, and also I should indicate the House of Representatives also introducing legislation advanced principally by Representative Pramila Jayapal from Washington. She's done the same thing in the House of Representatives. All of this legislation designed to overturn, to pull back on what the Supreme Court recently did. Of course, a big lift in Congress right now as the majority of the Republicans in the House, majority of the Democrats in the Senate, both razor thin, but nonetheless, introduction of legislation to move in that direction. To the same end, efforts in the United States Congress to overturn the decision in Trump versus United States that establishes, shockingly, this notion that our executive branch, our presidents, have some forms of immunity for crimes committed while they're in the Oval Office. Introduction of constitutional amendments in both houses of Congress to overrule that decision and establish that, indeed, there is no such thing as presidential immunity. Among others, Representative Joe Morrell, who is a Democrat from New York, introduced a constitutional amendment on Wednesday of this past week seeking to undo that Supreme Court decision that former presidents, current presidents, do enjoy some presumption of criminal immunity and even absolute immunity for some things. He said this, earlier this month, the Supreme Court of the United States undermined not just the foundation of our constitutional government, but the foundation of our democracy. This is Representative Morrell. He said, at its core, our nation relies on the principle that no American stands above another in the eyes of the law. And as a result of that, the representative has introduced this legislation that begins the process for a constitutional amendment requiring, obviously, endorsement by both houses of Congress, and after that, endorsements by three-quarters of the states. A huge lift, but nonetheless, beginning that process. Morrell said, the American people expect their leaders to be held to the same standards we hold for any member of our community. Presidents are not monarchy, he said. They are not tyrants and should not be immune. Thus, the introduction of this immunity package, this attempt to amend the Constitution to overcome what the Supreme Court has done in this case. Note also that the White House has indicated that sometime in this coming week, early in this coming week, President Joseph Biden is going to be announcing a similar package of proposals, legislative and constitutional amendments that address the same kinds of things. The only thing he is not going to be addressing is a notion of increasing the number of justices, which could also be done legislatively without a constitutional amendment. He is also concerned, again, about ethics. He is concerned about this immunity concept and other matters that presumably will be a part of his proposal to the United States Supreme Court, including a proposal for term limits, an interesting concept given what the Constitution says. All of that coming up, making this a continuing hot issue, and meaning that the decisions by the Supreme Court, while they remain good law as of today, certainly are attracting not only the attention of members of our Congress, should be attracting the attention of every single American. They change the way that government works, and they changed our very Constitution, the checks and balances that are out there. That decision having to do with Trump immunities and the Trump cases, of course, also impact virtually all of the cases pending in the federal and state courts as well. Those criminal cases, the four of them that we've talked about at great length in the past. Let's revisit some of those as well right now. We know that Tanya Chutkan, who is the district court judge who is presiding over the federal election interference case in the District of Columbia, she has now been given these cases back to her, the Trump immunity case, to try to sort out what is and is not official, what is and is not an absolute immunity and a presumptive immunity. Also sorting out what is left of this case after all of the evidentiary and procedural restrictions imposed upon the prosecutor by that Supreme Court case. She has now got back on her docket this case to figure out what comes next. Presumably some hearings with counsel to solicit from them their views upon what should and should not happen here. Major question that she will be asking is what is left after the United States Supreme Court virtually decimates major portions of that criminal indictment against Donald Trump, including establishing complete absolute immunity for anything engagement, any communications that he had with the United States Department of Justice. She will be entertaining that. She has got no small task. She is one of the judges in our land most burdened now by what the Supreme Court has done. Sort all of this out, the Supreme Court said, and give some life to this. Certainly a major task as she goes down this road, presumably in the weeks and months just ahead, even as this campaign goes forward. Presumably, Tanya Chutkan is going to be establishing a schedule for some of those as she takes up what the Supreme Court has now given to her. Speaking of schedules, we know that coming out of the 11th Circuit and coming out of Georgia, coming out of New York, also significant things having to do with the future of those cases as well. And as Amicus Law Review here continues in our next segments, we're going to discuss what the 11th Circuit did just this past week in determining the decision about whether or not that case, the Mar-a-Lago documents case, should continue in the federal district court. 11th Circuit issuing some major rulings. We'll also talk about New York and what Judge Juan Merchan has before him, as well as Amicus Law Review continues here on the broadcast stations of Civic Media.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Matt Nair on Air.
ABC News, I'm Dave Packer. Communication breakdown. Local SWAT team members on duty during the assassination attempt on former President Trump 2 weeks ago, speaking out exclusively to ABC News. Patrick Young, Chief Detective of Emergency Services in Beaver County, Pennsylvania, says a lot of respects. There was a communications failure before the gunman opened fire that day.
Multiple agencies working together is always taxing, no matter what the problem. I know that we could not communicate with Secret Service or Pennsylvania State Police, or really in effort, the patrol directly.
The world is watching the Middle East amid new fears of a larger war. A Hezbollah rocket killing 12 children and teenagers in the Israeli-controlled Golan Heights. Israel has blamed Hezbollah. U.S. diplomats working today to contain hostilities. Crews in California making progress on the Park Fire. It's larger than the city of Los Angeles, but now about 10% contained. This is ABC News.
This is your hometown radio, refreshed, keeping you informed, entertained, and connected locally across the Civic Media Network.
Are the Brewers in a slump? Hi, I'm Mike Clemens with sports. The Brewers losing to the Marlins again last night at AmFam Field, the final 7-3. Injuries like Christian Yelich out with a bad back. Younger players going 0-4 at the plate. Manager Pat Murphy asked, does he think his young Brewers team is in a slump right now?
Yeah, we got to go through it, man. We got to go through it with our heads on it, not shy away from it. We got to go through it. This is an incredibly young ball club that has played their guts out. Things are swaying the wrong direction for them right now. We're playing a team that nobody expects much from. They've played great. They've played great defense. They've swung the bat. They're aggressive. They're free. Berger and Bell and De La Cruz, and those guys are swinging it. You know, you can say they got nothing to play for, but they're major league players. They're really, really good. And they played really good against us, and we're not playing good. And we came off an emotional series. And concerned? Yeah, I'm concerned. But this is what young people go through.
That's Brewers manager Pat Murphy. With sports, I'm Mike Clemens.
You can always continue the conversation on social media. Share your thoughts when you find and follow Civic Media on Facebook, X, and Instagram.
I'm meteorologist Rodney Price. A mix of clouds and sunshine for your Sunday, but there will be a chance of some showers and thunderstorms in the afternoon. Highs warming to the middle 80s, south winds of 5 to 10. One or two showers or storms this evening, mostly cloudy, lows in the upper 60s. It's 78 at our studios.
Looking for a roundup of the day's important headlines in a quick podcast form? Search no more. Find it now at WGBW.FM. Your news just for the Green Bay area. I'm Lisa Hale with WGBW News.
It's time for the grooviest event of the summer at the Wisconsin State Fair. Wisconsin State Fair, presented by U.S. Cellular, August 1st through the 11th. Yeah, I'm feeling
good. My friends swim no matter the season, but my moderate to severe plaque psoriasis can sometimes take me out of the moment. Now, thanks to Skyrizi and Clear Skin, count me in. With Skyrizi, Risen Kizumab Riza, a prescription-only 150-milligram injection for adults who are candidates for systemic or phototherapy. 3 out of 4 people achieve 90% clearer skin at 4 months.
Don't use if allergic to Skyrizi. Serious allergic reactions and an increased risk of infections or a lower ability to fight them may occur. Before treatment, your doctor should check for infection and tuberculosis. Tell your doctor if you have an infection or symptoms, such as fever, sweats, chills, muscle aches, or cough, or if you plan to or recently received a vaccine.
Thanks to Skyrizi, there's nothing on my skin, and that means everything. Ask your doctor today about Skyrizi, the number one dermatologist-prescribed biologic in psoriasis, and visit SkyRizi.com or call 1-866-SKYRIZI to learn more.
Fear you may be missing out? We're always streaming on TuneIn and the Civic Media app. Enjoy listening live or catch up by finding the podcast at civicmedia.us or wherever you enjoy listening to your podcasts.
Pete Schwabba.
On the next Nightlight, I welcome radio legend Steve Cochran.
Stand-up comedian Zane Lamprey joins me to discuss upcoming dates on the Wisconsin leg of his national tour.
Nightlight with Pete Schwabba, weeknights 7 till 9.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus Law Review. We are in the midst of our review, which we sometimes do, of these four major criminal cases pending against Donald Trump, even as he continues as a candidate for the presidency of the United States of America. Talked about Tanya Chutkan, who now has this gargantuan task of figuring out what is the subject of immunity, what isn't the subject of immunity inside this indictment pending in the Federal District Court in the District of Columbia. Lots to do there, lots to unpack there, presumably some hearings in the months just ahead, even as that campaign goes ahead. We know as well that the other federal case, that it was the one that was pending in the Southern District of Florida, that's the Mar-a-Lago documents case, alleging that Donald Trump and two others, not only obstructive justice, but also engage in violations of federal law when it comes to the retention and use and possession of classified and other documents to which they're not entitled. That case dismissed recently by District Court Judge Eileen Cannon, finding that the prosecutor had no basis upon which to prosecute the case, that the attorney general appointing Jack Smith as special counsel is not constitutional, not supported by any statutory authority, and therefore the entire case goes away. She dismissed the case and closed the docket on it in the district court, much to the surprise of not only people inside the Department of Justice, but also on all sides of the political aisle once again, who viewed this decision as eminently overturnable, meaning that an appellate court, the 11th Circuit here, will almost certainly look at this and say no. Based upon history, based upon precedent, the notion that the special counsel does not have the authority is simply untenable. There's no basis for coming to that conclusion. But that case is now pending before the 11th Circuit. And what it means is that the case, that is the trial, the proceedings that move that case forward in the district court, are suspended. This past Thursday, the Court of Appeals, the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals, the one that oversees the district courts there, finally issued an order and provided information to the parties about the timing of their briefs. This is that period during which Jack Smith and counsel for Donald Trump will be filing written memorandums, written documents, setting forth their positions, establishing basically that there is simply no way that this matter will be tried anytime this year. And arguably not even a decision from the 11th Circuit anytime this year at all. Here's the schedule from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals telling Smith to file his initial brief expressing his views, expressing his positions on these issues by August 27th, about a month from now. Then Donald Trump's lawyers have 30 days after that to respond to that brief. And once that is done, Smith has the chance to file what's called a reply brief 21 days after that. So if you add all that up, you're coming up against almost Halloween, mid to late October, before the issues will even be briefed before the 11th Circuit. Presumably after that, the Court of Appeals will entertain some oral arguments, and then maybe, but unlikely, sometime late this year, issue its opinion, more likely in 2025. Getting a decision from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals on whether or not the dismissal of that case can be supported going forward. Again, a prediction here that the 11th Circuit, which has previously overturned Eileen Cannon and other untenable things that she has done, two different occasions, the 11th Circuit said, no, you're wrong. Anticipate that likely the 11th Circuit will say the same thing once again, return the case once again back to the district court for more proceedings sometime, likely in 2025. And then we also have two other cases, or the state cases. The Georgia case, also alleging election interference. That case also up on appeal from Judge Scott McAfee's decision. He dismissed about six counts out of that indictment. And he also found significantly, of course, that Fannie Willis, who's the prosecutor there, does not have to be taken off the case. No conflict of interest of such a nature that she would have to be removed from the prosecution. Finding an appearance of impropriety, but not sufficient to remove her from the case. And that decision, along with the dismissal of some of those counts, both of those things now in front of the Georgia appellate court. While that's going on, that case basically suspended unlikely that a trial will happen at any time soon in Georgia there as well. And finally, the one case that will in fact be involved in some significant activity fairly soon, that is a New York case. That is a New York case pending in front of Judge Juan Merchan. We talked a lot about this on this broadcast. That is the case, once again, that establishes, based upon the jury verdict, finding Donald Trump guilty of 34 counts, felony counts of false statements, fraud in connection with documents prepared, official records of the Trump Organization, involving the hush money payments to Stormy Daniels and the transactions involved in accomplishing that right before and after the 2016 election. That conviction of Donald Trump, a present candidate for the presidency, remains in place, but the district court judge there, Juan Merchan, suspended his plans to engage in sentencing a couple of weeks ago while he considers the impact of the Supreme Court decision, this immunity decision, on the trial of that case. And so he's soliciting and has gotten in some initial briefs in that case as well. The submission by the prosecutor there, Alvin Bragg, makes it clear that the government feels very strongly, as Juan Merchan will probably also conclude as well, that there's nothing to see here, that the issuance of the immunity decision should not, in fact, in any way impact the jury verdict, should not require a new trial, should not suspend the sentencing going ahead. What, in fact, did Alvin Bragg say just this past week? He said that there's no basis to overturn Donald Trump's conviction in this hush money case based upon that presidential immunity decision. Any error, he said, is harmless when viewed against the overwhelming evidence of a president's guilt. Now, Donald Trump's lawyers had argued that this conviction on 34 counts for falsifying these business records should be vacated because the Supreme Court had ruled that evidence of some of a president's official acts should not be used in the course of the trial. They specifically highlighted this notion that some testimony from White House aide Hope Hicks and some tweets from Donald Trump, both of those took place while he was actually the president. Presently scheduled to be sentenced in September, the sentencing, as I said, already delayed to allow arguments about this immunity issue. Prosecutors, once again, in their filing of this past week, dismissing all of that, saying that the crimes that Donald Trump was convicted of, this falsification of business records, happened before the 2016 presidential election, not a part at all of his official conduct, and that for that reason, the Supreme Court's ruling does not at all apply. Also noting that Trump's attorneys didn't raise objections during the trial itself to most of this evidence they now question, arguing that it's now too late to do that. Going on to say this, for all of the pages that defendant Trump devotes to his current motion, the evidence that he claims is affected by the Supreme Court's ruling constitutes only a sliver of the mountains of testimony and documentary proof that the judge considered in finding him guilty of all 34 felony charges beyond a reasonable doubt. The prosecution, Alvin Bragg, goes on to write this. He says, to the extent that the court concludes that any evidence of official presidential acts was improperly admitted at trial, the defendant's request to set that aside, to set the verdict aside, should be rejected on the harmless error grounds because the trial court contains The record of the trial court contains overwhelming evidence of the defendant's guilt. So what is that notion all about? Well, there's a harmless error concept in appellate review that basically says that even if there was error, not conceded here at all by the prosecution, saying, no, there wasn't error in doing this at all, these were not subject to the Supreme Court's ruling, but assuming that there was error in admitting these bits of evidence in, still it was harmless. Why? Because the jury's verdict based upon the overwhelming evidence could not be overturned, could not legitimately be attacked based upon just those very small slivers of things that was in fact presented in front of the jury. That was the harmless error analysis. The error, if any, in admitting that testimony, that evidence was harmless in the end, did not affect the jury verdict. And for that reason, Judge Juan Merchan, encouraged by the prosecution not to overturn the verdict, not to postpone further the sentencing. Prediction here, highly likely, that Judge Juan Merchan will reject the applications, these motions, these arguments of the defense, and affirm the jury verdict. And he will do that probably in a hearing coming up in September, followed by a written order, and proceed to sentence Donald Trump for the crimes that he was convicted of in that court sometime in mid-September. September 18th is the day that he has specifically identified for doing that sentencing. That prosecution, again, still going forward, lots of activity happening there in particular, again, in the wake of the Supreme Court decision finding that a sitting president does, in fact, have immunities. The argument that based upon the timing and the evidence in that New York case, none of that applicable, none of the terms of the Supreme Court decision prevent the court from going ahead with that prosecution. Now, certainly, Donald Trump, once this is all concluded, once the judgment is formally entered, a sentence formally entered, has the right to appeal that, and he will certainly do that after Judge Juan Merchan makes his decision on this immunity issue, the continued vitality of the jury verdict, and also sentence him. And Donald Trump can appeal all of that. He can appeal things related to the trial. He can appeal the decision likely to be entered by Judge Juan Merchan, indicating that he's not reversing the jury verdict. He can also appeal, that is, Donald Trump can appeal the sentence itself, finding that it's somehow illegal or unconstitutional. All of that can be wrapped up in an appeal to the higher court, which he will certainly do. Again, a prediction that Juan Merchan will go ahead. And long before the campaign is completed here, long before the November election, that this particular trial court matter will be concluded, even as it goes up on appeal. Highly likely that if the court does impose a sentence on September 18th, that will be stayed, probably not executed, will probably be stayed as the campaign goes forward, and specifically as the appeal on these underlying issues also proceeds, not going to be executed at any time while the appeal is pending. Juan Merchan will almost certainly stay his order to let that appellate process go forward. All of that pending, again, in the state and the federal courts of our land in the wake of what the Supreme Court did. No small consequence to these opinions, both in the Congress of the United States, in these courts, and also, I would argue, should be inside the minds and the hearts of all Americans as we think about what our country is and what the future of our nation is in the wake of this dramatic change in how our government works, that in the wake of Loper Bright, and this rescission of a major concept inside our Constitution about checks and balances, and significantly, most importantly, that a president should not be immune for crimes committed in the Oval Office. No one is above the law. In that connection, the Supreme Court, of course, continues to fill its docket for cases that's going to hear in the 2024-2025 term. And we turn now to some of those issues related to things happening right now, including just this past week. The Supreme Court has previously indicated it's going to be taking up a Tennessee law that bans gender-affirming care for transgendered youth. That's already on its docket. That's already going to be decided in the coming term. Motions and memorandums, briefs being filed in that case already. And the Supreme Court will be taking up oral argument in that case, deciding that in probably this time next year, late June, early July. Major U.S. medical groups like the American Academy of Pediatrics, the American Medical Association have opposed efforts by states to restrict gender-affirming care. And in the wake even of that, Tennessee enacted a law at the center of this case in 2023, bars gender-affirming care like hormone treatments, gender transition surgeries for transgendered patients under 18. That's what the law says. The law carved out two exceptions to that general rule, allowing the use of hormone treatments for other patients under 18, for those who already began puberty too early, and also allows healthcare providers to continue to administer hormone treatments for patients already receiving it. That's the law that's subject to the challenge. As we return here on Amicus Law Review, more about that Tennessee law and what the Supreme Court's going to be doing in the coming term as it takes up that significant case, that challenge to that law in Tennessee.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW.
Donald Trump brags he nominated the justices who overturned Roe v. Wade, getting rid of the constitutional right to abortion.
Well, I did something that nobody thought was possible. I got rid of Roe v. Wade. For 54 years, they were trying to get Roe v. Wade terminated, and I did it, and I'm proud to have done it.
Donald Trump not only took away abortion rights, he wants to monitor pregnant women and punish those who seek an abortion. Just listen.
Do you believe in punishment for abortion? Yes or no, as a principle?
The answer is that there has to be some form of punishment.
For the woman?
Yeah.
Banning abortion, monitoring and punishing women. That's how far Trump might go in a second term. Visit abetterwisconsintogether.org/TrumpMonitor to tell Donald Trump his views on abortion are too extreme for Wisconsin. Paid for by A Better Wisconsin Together, Inc.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home of Mino and the Mayor.
You're listening to pre-recorded content produced by Civic Media.
This is Amicus, the Law Review. We are talking about the next cases among the 20 or so cases already identified by the Supreme Court to be decided in its next term, including this major issue, which may animate a lot of what the Supreme Court is going to be focusing upon in the 2024-2025 term, and that is transgender rights. Much on the docket of the Supreme Court coming out of this Tennessee case. This legislation in 2023 that bars gender-affirming care, including hormone treatments, gender transition surgeries for transgender patients under 18, some exceptions to that, but that case coming up to the Supreme Court. Also, another case coming out of Kentucky. The legislature there in that state, a similar ban passed by the Kentucky legislature over a veto by Governor Andy Beshear. Seven transgender teens in that state, their parents went to court to challenge that similar Kentucky law, likewise seeking an order that would prohibit the state from enforcing its ban on puberty blockers and hormone therapy. The district court judge in that case had granted their request, put it on hold while the state appealed, and indeed a panel of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals reversed the trial judge's rulings and reinstated both the Tennessee and the Kentucky bans last fall. And so that's what brings us to the Supreme Court. The Supreme Court has now granted certiorari coming out of the Sixth Circuit Court of Appeals that had reinstated the legislative bans on gender-affirming care in both of those states, in Tennessee and Kentucky. That matter up for decision by the Supreme Court. And while that happens, having to do with gender-affirming care, another issue percolating up just this past week, and it has to do with something separate but much related. And it falls under Title IX, which is one of the major education statutes in our nation. The Biden administration establishing a rule under Title IX that expands existing federal protections against sex discrimination and harassment to include sexual orientation and gender identity. It would bar the refusal to use a student's preferred name or pronoun and would order schools to allow students to participate in athletics consistent with their gender identity. All those things are part of the rule under Title IX announced by the Biden administration. Again, it doesn't have to do with a care, which is the other case, but this has to do with inside the academic setting. What does discrimination mean? What does the prohibition against sexual orientation discrimination, gender identity discrimination mean? The Biden administration, again, through its education department, was aimed at strengthening the protections for gay and transgender students. And that happens to apply to some 10 different states under rulings from both the Fifth and the Sixth Circuits that happened just on Wednesday, again, coming out of the Sixth Circuit. The two rulings on a single day finding that this particular rule cannot stand, that it is unconstitutional, that is inconsistent with Title IX, that it is an exercise by the Department of Education that it's beyond the capacity of the administration to engage in, that now suspends that Title IX rule and prompts the administration to seek an emergency appeal on this matter to the Supreme Court. We talked before about Elena Kagan's feeling that these emergency appeals are overused. But both the Fifth and the Sixth Circuits just this past week, a day apart, overturned these rules by the Biden administration under Title IX that, again, would protect transgender students in the academic setting, ordering schools to allow students to participate in athletics consistent with their gender identity and requiring them to follow the students' preferred names or pronoun identities. That rule now suspended by the Fifth and Sixth Circuits, prompting the Solicitor General, her name is Elizabeth Perlegar, in an emergency request just this past week, telling the justices that they need to act promptly to restore the legitimacy, even temporarily, of these rules. She says that they should not have blocked all of the Title IX rules when the states claimed that they'd be injured only by provisions that force schools to allow the transgender students to use bathrooms and locker rooms that are consistent with their gender identity. She went on to say that the rule also requires staff and students, once again, to use a transgender student's preferred pronouns, all of that, as a part of her emergency application to the United States Supreme Court. The states once again had found that there was no harm to justify an injunction against the regulation provision that defines sex under Title IX, and that includes discrimination based on sex stereotypes, sex characteristics, pregnancy or related conditions, sexual orientation, or gender identity. She specifically invokes the rule in a case called Bostock, a rule that was articulated in a major opinion authored by the Supreme Court by Neil Gorsuch, writing on behalf of the majority, that specifically says that under the federal law that you cannot discriminate against people under Title VII based upon sexual orientation and gender identity, much related, again, to this issue. Now this one under Title IX, a different part of the federal statute. Government arguing that the decision by the lower courts, the Fifth Circuit, the Sixth Circuit in these cases, finding that this Title IX rule, the decision by the Biden administration to enforce transgender rights on behalf of students, that should not be pursued, that should not be upheld, and seeking an emergency appeal to the Supreme Court. The attorneys general, three of them in these various states, have asked the Supreme Court not to accept that appeal, not to put this on a fast track, not to review these matters in an emergency basis, and in fact, to support effectively the lower court decision to suspend the impact of these rules. The Tennessee Attorney General, his name is Jonathan Scrimeti, asked the justices in filing just as late as Friday to reject the government's emergency request to partially pause this order blocking this Education Department rule and asking again that the court not do anything here that would upset the normal course and permit nonetheless the application of the decision by the Fifth and Sixth Circuit to go ahead in its normal course. And that normal course, of course, would be appeal to the Supreme Court. That appeal, if in fact it does pursue on the normal course, would join this other matter that has to do with the gender-affirming care issue coming also out of the Sixth Circuit. The upshot of all this, a lot of focus these days upon the transgender rights of our population, including young people in academic settings and needing medical care. Significantly, the Nebraska Supreme Court also just this past week upheld a law restricting both medical care for transgender youth and abortion. A lot of things going on in this area having to do with transgender issues. We will continue to follow them in the future here on Amicus Law Review, not only in the state courts, not only in the appellate courts, but certainly as our United States Supreme Court now.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay, WGBW, home for Nightlight with Pete Schwabba.
Todd Albaugh.
Hey, everybody, join us next time as we'll take a look back at the weekend. And will Vice President Harris have a new VP? We'll catch up to speed. Join us.
The Todd Albaugh Show, weekdays noon till 2.
Let's get back to live music in the lair with Kaylin Cole. The next song you have for us tonight is called 1103. Yes. Is that a time or a flight number?
Oh, that's actually really good. That's a good idea. I think I might have to write another song with that. You'll get 50%.
It's live in the lair. Grab the podcast now at maxincradio.com and listen live on Saturday night, 6 to midnight, across the Civic Media Radio Network.
Enjoying this local program? Find the complete Civic Media lineup at civicmedia.us or the Civic Media app.
You're listening to the Talk of Green Bay.
WGBW 1590 AM Denmark. W250 CV Green Bay.
And always streaming on the Civic Media app.